Hello, Nerd Forensics fans. This is Millicent Oriana, and today I am joined again by Jacob Urban and my producer, Sophia Baca.
We are broadcasting from a scary-ass patch of forest somewhere in New Jersey, Philadelphia, or Maryland, being followed by some sort of Blair Witch, because turns out you can't find the BPRD headquarters if you just drive around New Jersey.
And today, I'm going to turn things over to Jacob because he's going to tell you all the story of Castle Eater. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Eater.
All right. Well, Jacob's going to tell us all the story about Castle Eater. And I'm just going to sit around and we're all just going to listen to a cool story tonight. So enjoy episode 6. They did not see that coming.
Millicent Oriana, culture expert. While seeking to unlock the secrets of all fandoms, she is exposed to an overload of every aspect of pop culture. Now, when asked a question about a piece of popular culture, she becomes curious. Now hosting a podcast and joined by amazing guests, she seeks to find answers and find a way to live off her talents and to make a fun podcast.
I'm going to ask you plenty of questions tonight, Jacob. I hope that's okay.
Sure.
So, Jacob, how about you get started on your story of Castle Eater?
Yeah, for sure. So I will preface this by saying that there are a lot of French names, German names, Austrian, and a couple of, I think, Ukraine or... Yeah, I think he was from Ukraine. So if I mispronounce any of these names, I do apologize. Just, you know.
And to our fans around the world from all those different countries, you get to laugh at us for our terrible pronunciation tonight.
Yeah, I mean, that is a plus. I know we do have some German listeners, so.
Well, and French and Greek and pretty much all over the world. And yeah, so yeah, you guys get to laugh at us tonight.
Yeah, you know, be kind. Okay, so let us begin. This is the Battle of Castle Eater. It is known as one of the strangest battles of World War II. The Battle of Castle Eater took place on May 5th, 1945 in the Austrian state of Northern Tyrol. What makes this one of the strangest battles of World War II is that it is only known occurrence of U.S. soldiers fighting alongside German soldiers, which were members of the German Wehrmacht. They fought side by side with U.S. soldiers, Austrian resistance members, and French prisoners.
Wow, so this must have been some really crazy stuff. This is like a Hydra level threat.
It's the final days of World War II. We'll get into why all these people join sides. So, the castle was being used to detain French VIPs to be used as hostages, including former prime ministers. Edward Daladier, who had signed the Munich Agreement and tried to flee the country when the Nazis had invaded, and Paul Reynaud, who had taken over after Daladier and had overseen the fall of France. There were some former generals, Maurice Gamelin, who had fought the Nazi invasion as the head of the French armed forces, and Maxime Weygand, who had replaced Gamelin. He had surrendered to the Nazis and had collaborated with them before being ousted and imprisoned for himself by the Nazis.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, working with them wasn't a good idea. They still threw you in prison.
Are we the baddies kind of thing?
Have you noticed that our caps have actually got little pictures of skulls on them?
I don't.
Hands. Are we the baddies?
Yeah. As you can probably tell, these two really did not like each other because, you know, the one fought for French resistance while the other pretty much just surrendered and collaborated.
Yeah, it went so far as to sign up for treason.
Yeah.
I surrender and volunteer for treason.
There was also the nationalist right-wing leader, Francois de la Roque, who was also a French resistance member. Then there's some weird stuff. There was a former tennis star, Jean-Robert Barrota. Yeah, he is just like this great French tennis player. And they're like, yeah, let's keep him.
Yeah, I couldn't see any of them. Okay, maybe Venus Williams, just like either the Williams sisters, because they're like so awesomely like good at tennis. And actually McEnroe. I could see McEnroe doing that. And I could see Pete Sampras doing that.
Also, I just wanted to insert, because you're talking about war and Vanessa Williams, that Randall Monroe from XKCD actually had her knock down a drone out of the sky.
Oh, I know.
And he thought he would take seven swings based on some back of the envelope math, and she did it in three.
That's actually why I thought about Venus Williams first. Is because I thought about her knocking that drone out of the air, and I could imagine her just knocking some dude out cold with a tennis ball. Yeah, we could have like no fatalities if like her and John McEnroe and them just attacked him with tennis rackets and balls. I mean, they'd probably all die instantly, but you know, they might get lucky. They might just like concuss a bunch of dudes with tennis balls.
You know, you might have just come up with a new form of warfare.
Yeah. So yeah, just to let the Defense Department know, I am available to work for DARPA. I mean, if you guys want, I could teach you about like tennis racket technology and tennis ball technology. And we might find a way to win wars.
Using our new armed forces that are armed, fully equipped to play a tennis match.
Yeah, it'd be like that movie with Benicio del Toro and Tommy Lee Jones, The Hunted. Except for instead it'd be John McEnroe teaching them all like play tennis and like control their anger. Like McEnroe, I want to say he threw his racket into a crowd during Wimbledon and stuff. Like he was cool.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So back to the story. Charles de Gaulle's sister Maria Agnes was a prisoner here, and she was a part of the French Resistance. Charles de Gaulle was the leader of Free France, and that acted as the exiled government during the occupation and had organized a large part of the French Resistance.
From occupied Algeria, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
We're going to fight the imperialists from Algeria, which we conquered.
You know, Europe...
there were bigger things at stake for the minute. I agree.
Yeah.
They should have gotten their asses out of Algeria right afterward, but they should have never been there in the first place. But again, the Nazis were kind of a big threat.
I mean, you know, a lot of like the superpowers of Europe at the time, they had been colonizing places for centuries at this point.
Oh, I know. And it never went well.
No.
It never went well once. Like,
no.
It was actually like the worst thing ever everywhere they did it.
Yeah.
Turns out the only people that ever had colonization right probably were the Polynesians. And that was just because they found empty islands and they were like, all right, new home.
Like, yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
But, I mean, when you can find empty places and then go new home,
beat us all to it, though. I mean, granted, the Polynesians were the ones that found all the empty islands.
Sorry, I need to jump in here. They did find them last, but remember that diagram where it's like the first wave went to like it's the Southern Africa and like the Middle East, and then went to like Europe, pushed into like Asia, and then across the land bridge, and then the fourth wave went into like Polynesia and Australia.
Oh, I know, because they had amazing boats. I mean, don't get me wrong. The closest like Europe had were the Vikings. People were just assholes back then.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Like, if anybody could have learned to share, it would have been fine. But that's just not, like, the prerogative from Europeans back then. We got buckles on our shoes. Therefore, we're going to just, like, kill you if you disagree with us. It's the weirdest prerogative ever.
I mean, you know, they were looking out for their own interests.
Yeah, but it seems to me like you can make, like, alliances with people without killing them.
They did.
But then they killed them.
Yeah, you know, they did. They made alliances all the time.
Yeah, I know. And then they betrayed them. Like, what? Why does every country, like European country and countries settled by European people, do that? Or sorry, not settled, stolen. I should say stolen, because stolen is the appropriate term.
It might have something to do with the mini ice age that happened, and they all just had collective trauma from that for centuries.
Yeah, I mean. I think it was Bill Burr that said that, like, it's cold as hell, and that's why people, like, conquer, is because they don't want, like, that's why you never see anybody from somewhere good conquering. There's always places that are cold as shit.
Yeah, you want to get out of the cold, and you want, like, plentiful amounts of food.
Well, that was their fucking fault for settling those places in the first place.
It was available land.
Well, it wasn't available. You had to, like, bash somebody for it. Oh, you mean Europe when they settled?
Yeah,
the cold
yeah.
places. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, when they settled in the cold places, it was what was left available.
Yeah, well, that was their fault.
For being
for being last, yeah. I mean, okay, look, if we're gonna keep believing in capitalism and keep supporting something that's complete bullshit, like, we gotta at least like just accept that white people came last in that and they should have to all be exiled to cold places. And that's why I am pro not capitalism, is because I don't believe in that. But I think that like if we're gonna keep believing capitalism, we should just all exile every white person to a cold place. Because that's where they picked. They like, you know, first come, first serve. That's what they picked.
Okay. I don't even know where that's going. All right. So back to the prisoners. There's a trade union leader and a future Nobel Prize recipient, Leon Jahoux. There's Jahoux?
Let me see.
J-O-U-H-O-U-X.
I'm guessing it's Jahoux.
Well, while Sophia's taking the time to look up how to pronounce this word, I want to tell everybody again about Patriot Porridge. Patriot Porridge. If you eat it, you'll be happy with where you live. I guarantee it. Also, just to let everybody know, as a podcaster, we don't know what the fuck we're talking about half the time. Yeah, we might sound smart, and we might make you laugh, but none of us know what the hell we're talking about.
I mean, it's just between recording and when I was doing my research, because I heard the name spoken, but it's been a little while, so I've just forgotten it.
Oh, not about that. I'm just saying, though, if I ever tell anybody something and they think they should live their life according to what I say, that's what I was talking about. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about half the time. I'm saying if somebody hears this and they go like, oh, yeah, I should definitely do this. It's like, no, you should not. I've learned that about every podcaster. You should not live your life based on what they say. But, you know, sometimes you get a nugget of wisdom or two.
Yeah.
Jahoux.
Mm-hmm. All right. Leon Jahoux.
Jahoux.
So, yes, you know, French listeners, I do apologize. Believe me, it is not intentional that I butcher these names.
Japanese listeners are going to laugh because it sounds like we're saying Jew-own.
And then Michael Clemenceau, the son of George Clemenceau, who was the only prisoner who could speak fluent German. So this guy was pretty useful for the other prisoners.
Yeah, no kidding. Speaking of like only being able to speak one language, like one guy, you've heard about that failed German infiltration during World War II, right?
Yes.
Where they like. They sent like 1,000 dudes and only like 100 of them spoke English or whatever. And
it usually wasn't that well.
It wasn't that well. And they would use terms like up your bottom instead of bottoms up. And then oust them right away. Yeah. I just always thought that was pretty funny. And the rest of them were ordered apparently to just smile and nod.
Yeah. Because they were going to be caught instantly.
Yeah, which I think it made it easier to catch them.
So there was as well a detachment of workers transferred from Dachau prison camp and to be used as workers for maintenance and other menial tasks. So they were going to be like servers and stuff because this is French aristocracy. So they're sure as shit not going to do that. And then their German guards, they're not going to do that. So they had to get somebody to like keep this castle operating.
Yeah, to serve like the lords and barons and just that all live there.
No. Okay, so here's what happened. Basically, when the Nazis invaded, they were going because this camp's in Austria. So they showed up and they're like, "Hey, you know, we're gonna let you keep this place." And then they pretty much just took it and kicked the owner out.
So I'm getting a pattern of you shouldn't trust Nazis.
No, you definitely shouldn't trust Nazis.
Huh.
So one of these prisoners was a man named Zvonimir Chukovich and Andreas Krobot. A little later on in this tale, they become very important. And now here we go. The castle itself was built on the remains of a former castle in 1878 and had been extensively remodeled throughout the following years. In 1940, the Nazi government seized the castle and used it initially as the HQ for the German Association for Combating the Dangers of Tobacco. Because,
you know, I know them. They're called Truth now.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, Hitler was, like, super anti-smoking.
Oh, I know. And it's okay to lie to people as long as it gets them to stop smoking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally okay. I'm pretty sure the Nazis came up with that, but, you know.
Now, by 1943, it was used as a subcamp of Dachau prison. As Nazi prisons go, it wasn't, like, as bad as many of the others. Because, again, these were high-value prisoners. And they had access to amenities other prisoners did not, such as a library, somewhat decent food, and the ability to walk around freely within the grounds of the castle. So this is not like the labor camps that they had set up.
Yeah, this sounds to me kind of like those the royal families in Persia, the male heirs, how they would keep them all like locked up in they're called pleasure palaces.
Yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't like that.
They didn't get like food and prostitutes and stuff whenever they wanted, but you know,
it wasn't as bad as being in like an actual labor camp.
Yeah,
like this is more of an actual prison, but it's like the CEOs who like commit tax fraud. It's like the prisons they go to.
Yeah, the ones that they see. I think like it would be cool if they just like switched places with like, you know, drug dealers and stuff. If they were just like, well, you stole money from the American people, we're gonna lock you up in Pelican Bay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Awesome. I mean, we should reform our prisons so like all prisons are like those high class prisons. Because, you know, that's how like most of the world works, where they treat them like people and like feed them and stuff. But, you know, unfortunately, in America, we have this thing where like just giving them a book to read is like a fucking stretch, because we're like, no, we can't do that. These people need to be locked up in an angry box.
And they need to be made to suffer constantly.
So they get angrier. And if they ever get out, they just come right back.
I just wanted to interject here that there's a prison in Kentucky where workers earn something like 15 cents an hour, and reading books is like a dollar per minute.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That
and,
sounds
yeah,
like an American prison.
And I know, you know, y'all have some Swedish listeners, and, you know, I bet a lot of our listeners, because I mean, I was going to say also, you when you said most of the world, most of like the developed world, but still.
Oh. Yeah, there are some really bad prisons outside the United States.
I know. There are like prisons in Brazil and stuff that are like nightmarish. But like I was looking at this Romanian prison and how it's like illegal for guards to confiscate personal property as long as it's not contraband. So it's like you can actually live a kind of cozy life.
Yeah. I mean, again, though, you know, our whole idea of prison is punitive, where a lot of other developed nations, it's reformative.
Oh, I know. We're a bunch of cavemen, though, and we should just bring back horse whipping.
I mean,
we basically just turned the stockade into an angry box.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like the outcomes are worse.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, you could horse whip somebody to death very easily if you weren't careful, but you don't just set them up for a perpetual cycle of being in and out of prison and they never really learn how to function in society.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I would rather have us throw tomatoes at people. You know, they'd learn their lesson, it sounds like.
Yeah, for petty crimes.
Yeah, for petty crimes.
We definitely need prisons. We don't need for-profit prisons.
Yeah.
That's just dystopian as all hell.
We also need our prisons to be like more therapeutic, like more like a mental institution.
Yeah.
And not like American mental institutions, or like, you know, like old American mental institutions, the good ones they had for like 10 years back in like the you know, I don't know, remember when it was, but when they reformed mental health for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So back to the story. At this time, the prison was headed by SS officer Sebastian Vimmer. Vimmer had instructed the guards to largely ignore and even befriend the prisoners when possible. Because he was like, these guys are valuable after the war, you know, they might be able to get me some money or something. The prisoners did not make this easy, though, as many of them disliked one another and had split into three factions. The rightists, the leftists, and the neutrals. And these three factions refused to interact with each other.
God, yeah.
So you had the one faction that was like super French resistance, like let's have a free France. You had the rightists that were kind of like, no, this, you know, it might not be all that bad. And then the people in the middle who just for whatever reason couldn't make up their mind about this.
And yeah, so it sounds like American politics.
Like, yes, actually it does.
Where like there are people in the middle, like most of America, who are just like, oh, I can't make up my mind. And then people on the left who are just like,
we have several demands. The rich should give their money to the poor. Then the new rich should give their money to the new poor. And then they should go round and round like the Sneetches? Is that what that is?
And then you have people on the right who are like, you know, abortion clinics are turning babies into dynamite.
And, you know, maybe a dictatorship isn't that bad as long as we're the dictators.
Yeah, as long as, like, you know, let's bring back a king. It will make them stop making the babies into dynamite to sell to Al-Qaeda.
Oh, my God. Modern-day monarchists just, like, upset me.
Oh, I know.
I mean, you have the right to believe what you want to believe, but sometimes your belief isn't correct. Like, I don't have the supreme authority to make that, but that's just the way I feel about it.
Yeah, I'm gonna say, like, from what I've seen, like, okay, people on the right aren't entirely bad.
Oh, no.
But I, from what I usually see, like, you usually get, like, I mean, don't get me wrong, you'll get, like, those leftist revolutions where a bunch of people die and stuff. Like, Pol Pot's a great example of that.
Yeah.
Entire Khmer Rouge was, like, absolutely insane. But you tend to get a lot of, like, you know, the Spanish fascist and stuff like that, like what's his name, Franco. You get that kind of shit from the right, though, and those people, you know, they, good God.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, it's like, I'm not trying to get too deep into American politics, and you know, there are good people on both sides of the aisle, but it doesn't mean that they're right politically.
Yeah, and the people that can't make up their minds are definitely wrong.
Yeah.
Because they're not doing anything. They just can't make up their mind.
Yeah. So by 1945, the war was going pretty badly for the Germans. To the point it was obvious to the prisoners. You know, they're hiding this information from them. And they can even tell. These guys are losing now. So Michael Clemenceau asked Wimmer to a meeting with him. Paul Reynard and General Gamblin, and ask for the assurances that they and the other prisoners were not going to be executed when the prison fell. Wimmer did assure them that he did not want that and had even told them if it came to it that he would help them escape.
Hmm.
Now, on April 29th of 1945, the Allies had reached and liberated the main camp of Dachau, 93 kilometers north of Eder. The news of this arrived quickly, but so did a man named Edward Viter, who had no real impact other than being made Dachau Camp Commandant in 1943. He was made the Commandant in 1943, but the dude just kind of rode a desk the entire war. Like, he didn't do anything.
Probably signed a bunch of, like, really fucked up papers that killed people and stuff, but, you know.
Yes. Now, Viter had written that he had no political ideology or identity.
See, that's what I'm saying. Those middle-of-the-road people wind up, like, helping the Nazis. They don't know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, so he didn't have, like, he wasn't involved in politics, and he mostly neglected his duties, actually.
Okay, that's the first thing I've heard about a Nazi that I like, is that they neglected their duties.
Yeah, like, he did not care. He was checked out before the war even started.
Nice. That's pretty awesome. Just like, but you know, it's still, you know, you're complicit in some pretty awful stuff. But,
yes.
You know.
So even though there are, you know, German soldiers in this story that what it kind of sounds like they're doing heroic things. And then to a degree they are, but they were still Nazis. These were not good people. They helped, like, participate in a genocide, like,
yeah.
So don't make it seem like I'm not trying. This is just the information. I'm not trying to, like, make them sound like they were great people.
Oh yeah. Oh no, I didn't think you were. I'm just adding this dialogue just because you know, it really helps people know that, you know, we are definitely
yeah. No, I just want to clarify that for myself, though, like, I don't want any of our listeners to think I'm idolizing Nazis here, because I'm not.
None of us are.
Can I just ask, so you're saying that Beetle Bailey would be the best Nazi?
Yes, Beetle Bailey would be the best Nazi. And we need to be less like Beetle Bailey, and we need to be more like BJ Blazkowicz.
I mean, I agree with this, too.
Yeah, I mean, I play Wolfenstein and 1 and 2, the new ones, and, like, I mean, yeah, I agree with him on that entire issue. Get rid of white supremacy.
He is accused of carrying out the mass execution of the 2,000 prisoners before the liberation of Dachau.
Exactly. Exactly. There was something terrible there. Yeah,
like, unfortunately, it's one of those issues. It's one of those things where the records are just gone. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if he actually did, but he is the one who is blamed for it.
Yeah.
So there's a good chance he probably did it. Now, no one knew what to expect with his arrival and had feared that he had come to execute these prisoners as well. It is unknown what his intentions at Eder were, because on May 2nd, news of Hitler's death reached the castle, and one of two things happened. Either Vitor drew his pistol and shot himself in the heart and then the head, or he was killed by other SS member angry over his lack of ideological conviction. There is some debate on this subject.
My God, is this going to be the Nazi Alamo? Oh, Jesus Christ. Like, so it's even stupider Alamo. God damn it.
Well, I mean, calling it the Alamo isn't, like, the worst description, but just wait and see.
Sounds like it's going to be the even stupider Alamo.
But yeah, so basically, he shot himself in the heart. And then when that didn't kill him, he must have been in excruciating pain and then shot himself in the head.
Okay, that's pretty cool.
Or somebody, another dude shot him in the heart and then, seeing he wasn't dead, shot him in the head. So either way, he went through excruciating pain.
And that proves that Nazis were really terrible shots, which, I mean, everything I had ever heard about them, they were. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah. So at this point, panic had started to take hold of the prison, and on the night of May the 3rd, Vemer and his men had abandoned the prison. So that was the guy who was running it initially. They just checked out.
God damn it.
And with that, along with his promise to Michael Clemenceau of helping them escape.
Okay, the only thing that's worse than being a Nazi is being a shitty Nazi.
Yeah, being a cowardly Nazi.
Yeah, being like a shitty.
I mean, say what you want about the tenets of National Socialism, dude. At least it's an ethos.
No.
If you're like Oscar Schindler, though, then that's cool.
Yeah. No, Oscar Schindler was awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. Like, if you're, like, giving the Nazis, like, dud shells and stuff, then it is cool to work for them.
And, you know, you're trying your damnedest to help free people.
Yeah, and you're, like, you know, giving the Nazis, like, just crap. Like, yeah. That doesn't work right. That is pretty cool.
Yeah. No, that he was, like, the only good Nazi.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there was probably, like, a handful more, but...
Oh, and the guy with the eye patch tried blowing up Hitler. That guy was cool.
Kind of. He was cool for trying to blow up Hitler,
I know. His campaign in North Africa was probably really effed up, like Rommel's campaign in North Africa. And I fucking can't stand when people like idolize Rommel and stuff like that. It's like, they were Nazis.
Yeah.
They were all Nazis. The only good Nazi was Oscar Schindler.
Yeah. So, now earlier in the day, Zvonimir Chuchkovich had left the castle under the pretext of running an errand for Vemer, but in reality, he had a letter in English asking for Allied assistance and was instructed to give it to the first Americans he had come into contact with. So, he was given a list that basically was like, or not a list, a letter that basically was like, French prisoners here, please help. And he's just like,
Jesus Christ,
going up to, like, he was told to find the first Americans he saw.
God damn. Okay, so this Vemer guy, it's like the equivalent of, like, abandoning a burning building and finding a dog and attaching a note that says burning building.
No, Vemer didn't send him.
Oh,
it was the other French prisoners that sent him, and they just lied to the guard saying, oh yeah, he wants me to go do this.
Oh, well.
Because Nazis are stupid, too.
God damn, they're stupid. They're cowardly. Like, this castle is full of, like, idiots, it sounds like.
Yeah, this is why this is such an interesting story.
Jesus Christ.
Now, at this point, roving bands of SS units were terrorizing the countryside and killing pretty much anyone they encountered. Because Berlin has fallen, Hitler's dead, we're just gonna take everybody we come across.
God, these dudes, like, honestly, this is the dumbest fucking strategy I've ever heard in my life.
That the SS units were just trying to kill random people?
Yeah, it's like, okay, that just, oh God, like, everything I hear, I'm just like, this is getting stupider by the minute.
Yep. Chuchkovich had two options. He could head to the town of Wurgel, which was 5 miles down the mountain, but was still under German control, or head to the city of Innsbruck, which was 40 miles away, but a base for U.S. soldiers.
I would have gone to Innsbruck.
Well, you would have made his choice.
Yeah, it sounds like the most certain choice. The SS won't be there to kill me.
Well, actually, though, because, again, this is 5 miles versus 40, there was a lot more chance of him running into SS in the woods.
Oh, yeah, but I'm saying in the town. Like,
yeah, once you got to the town, you were safe. You were safe as you were going to be.
Yeah, but, you know, there might be SS all over that town, too, though.
Well,
it's 5 miles away.
Yeah, they actually were. So
yeah, I was right.
He ultimately decided to head towards Innsbruck and had arrived late in the evening and making contact with the 409th Infantry Regiment of the 103rd Infantry Division. So he made it. He made it to the Americans. He did find them.
No.
Now, at dawn on May the 4th, a rescue was mounted, but the attempt had been stalled by heavy shelling, with the unit being stopped a little more than halfway to the castle.
Why are there so many holdouts, like, when this kind of shit happens?
I mean, they were pretty certain that the Americans weren't going to take them prisoners.
I mean, yeah, I get it. I mean, it's like...
I mean, you remember in Saving Private Ryan when they had them and they just started shooting them?
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm like, yeah, that's actually a good point there. Like, I guess, but, you know...
Like, they were just, by this point, it was, I'm gonna kill me some Nazis.
Yeah, that's right. That was after they had started liberating the death camps and stuff, so.
Yeah.
People were mad.
Yeah, people were really mad by what, especially the Americans and, like, the French and the English. They were all very mad.
I think it's fascinating, though, that all those countries, it had the Nazis not invaded them or attacked them. They were all very pro-Nazi up until that point.
I mean, you gotta remember, fascism was very popular all over Europe at this point. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate. Like, it's kind of funny, too, though, because, like, it kind of, like, you know.
I mean, had the Nazis not done what they did, there would be probably a lot more fascist governments still operating.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Like, World War II is what, like, kind of gave us all a bad taste for fascism.
Well... It did and it didn't. I mean, look at the Dulles brothers and, like, all the countries they rebuilt.
Yeah, well, so it was a different kind of fascism.
Yeah, we stopped using the word.
Yeah.
We started calling it democracy.
And it was way more based around capitalism.
Yeah.
Ugh. So inside the castle on May 4th, inside the castle, the prisoners had begun to arm themselves with... abandoned equipment and were preparing to defend themselves from the roving SS units. So they were like getting ready to go to fucking war, essentially, because they're like, they're gonna kill us if they come in here. Now, not knowing what had happened to Chukovich, the leaders of the prison accepted a offer from the prison cook Andreas Krobot to take a bicycle to Wurgel and seek assistance there. So this is the town that was 5 miles away.
Oh no.
Carrying a similar note, Krobert made contact with the Austrian resistance members. But he, like, again, there are still Nazis in this town. So doing that probably took some balls.
Mm-hmm. Good thing he ran into the Austrian resistance.
Yeah. The town had recently been abandoned by the Wehrmacht and had been reoccupied by Waffen SS troops. So these were the really bad Nazis.
True believers.
Yeah. So this is, it is really good that he found the Austrian resistance.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because they would have shot him right then and there. Now, Krobot was taken to meet Major Joseph Gengel. He commanded the remains of the Wehrmacht soldiers who had defied orders to leave the town and had taken up arms with Austrian resistance to defend the town's people from SS reprisals. So this guy is like...
Okay, so the Wehrmacht are doing something noble.
Yeah, and again, this guy, he was a Nazi, but over the last, like, 6-7 months, he's really became disillusioned with it all.
I mean, that's the thing, too. Like, it's one of those things where, like, a lot more people knew what the hell was going on than say they did.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those things where the Kool-Aid starts wearing off. I mean...
Exactly, and that's what was happening with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was not a true believer anymore.
Oh, sorry. I just had a funny image in my head. Just like this dust in the wind, like playing in the background, and like this Nazi just like in a field, and then puts his armband on like the tree and just looks at it, and then looks at the sunset and then sighs, and it's like, is this for me? And they skips a stone.
Now, like I said, like 6-7 months before all this happened, he was still a loyal soldier, but So yeah, before Hitler had committed suicide, Gangl had already been in talks with the Austrian resistance, which he was then made the head of. So they were like, hey, you're an actual soldier. You fought in this war. You probably know how to command better than we can.
I mean, and that's the thing, too. Like, there are points where you got to just like, okay, dude, you know what? Still a war criminal probably and everything, but at some point you got to let bygones be bygones just because...
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I'm sure the people who, you know, got genocided would have to say like completely opposite things. But some of them might even be like, hey, OK,
like he is the most qualified person here. Yeah.
And he is fighting against them. So,
yeah,
I mean, it's all a fucking moral hornet's nest.
Yeah, again, the Wehrmacht are not the good guys in this story.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, they were Nazis.
Yeah. At this time, a unit of Sherman tanks of the U.S. 23rd Tank Battalion of the 12th Armored Corps under the command of Captain John Lee had reached Kirstein, Austria, which was about 8 miles north of Wargel. Krobot had convinced Gangl to help him and his fellow prisoners. Gangl had his men make a white flag and started to drive towards Innsbruck when they came across Lee's 23rd Tank Battalion. So they were like, hey, we're surrendering. And then they came up to the Americans.
Did they get machine gun like Saving Private Ryan?
No.
Oh.
And it's actually a good thing.
Well, yeah, it sounds like... I mean, you shouldn't kill people if they're surrendering.
Yeah. No, you shouldn't. Gangl immediately asked Lee for help, and after getting permission from his superiors, Lee volunteered to lead the mission. So Lee was given permission to work with this guy and...
take the castle.
Yeah, and defend it. Because, again, they were like, the Nazis are going to kill these people.
Yeah.
The SS is going to kill them. Lee took 2 tanks and 14 men with him and combined with Gangl's 10 Wehrmacht soldiers and thus began the only mission where the two sides were allied. On their way to the castle, the group was stopped by having to disable SS booby trap, and due to a tenuous bridge that proved to be incredibly difficult to cross with only 1 tank... they had to leave the other behind to defend the bridge. So now they're down a tank.
Yeah, that's not good.
And then they came across a group of SS soldiers trying to set up a roadblock, but as soon as they saw the tank, they were scared and ran away. Yeah, they just took off running.
Well, I would too. I mean, it's a tank. Like, and it's a good made tank. I mean, I know the Germans had the worst... Okay, just those elephant tanks. I don't know about the rest of their tanks, but I know the elephant tanks were made like it.
Yeah.
So I just love the idea that they're like, oh, no, that's a good tank. Yeah. Run.
Are those the ones that could be disabled by gasoline?
They were the ones that were disabled with a gas can and a lighter. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is exactly how Russians would take them out on the Russian front, is they would take gas cans, climb on top of the elephant tank and just dump a can of gas on the hatch. And because they rushed production, they didn't have a bottom escape hatch, and they didn't have any guns on the sides. So
they just cook them.
Yeah, or suck all the air out if you didn't open the hatch.
Yeah.
So either way, you died horribly. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's a shitty tank if it can get taken out with a gas can.
Yeah, these guys just ran into the forest. Now, because of this roadblock and them running into like a kind of specific area, it was pretty clear to the Allies that they were gonna attack the castle. Like, yeah, they kind of knew this was gonna happen.
Yeah, they were setting up for an attack. Yeah. That's what the roadblock was for.
Now, back at the castle, the French prisoners had requested a SS officer, Kurt Siegfried Schrader, to take charge of the castle defense. He didn't leave. Like, it was just the other guy. Vemer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, speaking of American tanks showing up, do you want to do a whole episode about how that movie La Vita Bella just, like, totally trivializes the Holocaust?
Oh, yeah, La Vita e Bella by Roberto Benigni.
Yeah. Yeah, how that movie is, like, one of the worst movies ever just because of how much of, like, a trivia it makes the Holocaust into.
It's like, the most liberal movie ever in, like, in certain ways.
Yeah, it's, like, so just, like, well, it couldn't have been all that bad.
the idea that a father could hide the Holocaust from his son, even if he did have special waiter privileges. It's like,
I know, it's ridiculous. It's like, God, what? Yeah, we'll talk about that some other time. Go ahead and get back to it, Jacob.
So the reason Schrader was at the castle was he was recovering from wounds he sustained in an American bombing raid. And he ended up befriending some of the French prisoners. Schrader agreed to help if he could move his wife and children into the castle while he was there. So he was like, yeah, I kind of like you guys, but I need a place that's safe for my family, too.
I mean, castle's the safest place. And that is going to conclude part one of Castle Eater. And I hope you all have a great rest of your night. We're going to end it on that great cliffhanger. Tune in next time when we do Castle Eater, part two. And I've been Millicent Oriana, and today I was joined by
Jacob Urban.
And my producer,
Sophia Baca from Santa Fe Trail Media, host of Breaking Math Podcast at Pod Sophia.
And of course, you can always reach me at Camp Pod Millie at Twitter, which is Camp with a K. You can also reach me at patreon.com/nerdforensics if you want to give me money to make a better show with more lasers and sound effects. And I mean, I'm sure you won't be able to see my fog machine, but it will make the show cooler. And you can also reach me at nerdforensics@gmail.com. And you can reach me at nerdforensics on Facebook. Lord loves a working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor. Get it taken care of.